Good morning. Well, it's great to have you all back with us. So it's a big hello from Debbie Evans and myself, Brian Gerrish. Welcome back to The Green King. I think we're up to episode 5, but I am going to say very gently that we had a little bit of a glitch with our numbering system, and there's been some parts that you may have seen on screen for the previous ones. We're going to stick with this one at episode 5 and just continue with the episode numbering. The other thing we'd like to say before we get going is that Debbie and myself have been really surprised and very thankful for all the wonderful emails that people have sent in, because the moment one of the episodes has gone out, we've had a stream of emails on a daily basis of people saying how much they've enjoyed it, how much the series has made them think. And for some people, oh my goodness, I had no idea what he's up to. So Debbie, that's a really wonderful bit of feedback from our audience.
Good afternoon. Well, good morning. Good afternoon, wherever you are, where you're watching. But honestly, I think I'd describe it as overwhelming. I mean, I've just been overwhelmed by the incredible response that we've had from so many people. And, you know, I'm just so glad that people are enjoying it, because we're living in dark times at the moment. And some of this material is dark, but we're enjoying it as well, aren't we, Brian? You know, we've lit that match, we've lit the fuse already 4 times. We're ready to light it again. And thank you. Thank you to everyone who's sending us information. And I think it's important to say that all the information you're sending, we are collating and going through. And this is number 5. With all the information we're getting in, Brian, this is going to carry on, isn't it?
Well, indeed it is. And we can't reveal all the secrets, but actually earlier this morning, we were having a look at our research, and particularly Debbie's research about King Charles. And there is so much, as Debbie has just said, there's so much for us to cover. We can see that we're going to just keep going with this topic, and it's going to get more and more interesting. Now, Debbie, before I let you loose, I just wanted to put a couple of the books up on screen that I've mentioned before, because a couple of members of the audience have said, what were those books? Who will rule the New World Order? Prince Charles, The Sustainable Prince by Joan Vion. And this is the other one, The Prince and the Paranormal, The Psychic Bloodline of the Royal Family by John Dale. I'm going to read, if you'll bear with me, a little bit about a little bit out of Joan Vion's book, Prince Charles, the Sustainable Prince, just to show you the connectivity between the research that Debbie has been doing and people that have been looking at Charles in the past. So this is chapter 8 of that book, Prince Charles, the Sustainable Prince. And the subsection is Corporate Governance. And it says this: although the Prince of Wales Business Leaders Forum was established in 1990, it was not until the president of the World Bank, James Wolfensohn, met the Prince in New York in July 1996 that a more formal alliance, we are told, was begun between the two. At the September 1996 annual meeting of the IMF World Bank, a workshop on corporate governance was conducted. During a telephone interview with James Newson from the Prince of Wales Business Leaders Forum on September the 9th, 1997, I was told that the forum had signed an alliance with the World Bank in early 1997. So remember, that's the Prince of Wales Business Leaders Forum had signed an alliance with the World Bank in early 1997. This alliance is a 3-year research project being undertaken by the forum with the bank and the United Nations Development Programme. And what were they doing? Well, this is what Joan tells us: to identify, analyse and promote examples of how business is working in partnership with public sector institutions, non-governmental organisations and other private sector enterprise to play a creative and positive role in the process of development. And I just thought, Debbie, that paragraph was so telling, because here he was just casually setting up a quick alliance with the World Bank and the UN, and it's all about change, and he's in the driving seat, it would appear.
As you do. I mean, you know, this is just what you do, isn't it? And I thought it does. It dovetails really, really well into all of this research, just dovetails really well. But I have to say, I don't know if the lovely Stephanie Sinclair, our wonderful producer, can go back to that first screenshot. Prince Charles, the sustainable prince. I just want to say a couple of things about that, because who are we talking about sustaining here? Sustaining Prince Charles is what I think, because these sustainable goals and these sustainable initiatives that he's so promoting, what is sustainable about the United Kingdom, for example, at the moment? We've got a health system that's unsustainable, that's been made unsustainable deliberately. We've got a cost of living that's been made unsustainable deliberately. The whole country, we've got a food production that's unsustainable because deliberately they're destroying it. So who are we actually sustaining here? Is it the king and the royal family and the nobility and the elite? Because I'm seeing him setting up an empire for a very selective few.
Well, I'll just add to that. When you talk about, you know, the destruction of the UK, which, you know, we could talk about for a long time, but I think most people are aware of the sense of chaos and breakdown. But in the revolutionary change model, you have to destroy the old before you can bring in the new. And there's a quote, I'm sorry, I don't know where it came from, but it's the revolution eats its young. So the revolution sets up people to create this change. Everything will be better under the new regime in the future. But actually, before you can get there, you have to destroy what's in existence. And then you actually also destroy the people that help you create the revolution in the first place. But I think that King Charles is heavily in bed with revolutionary change. That's just my two penneth worth to start today off, Debbie.
Well, destroy first, and then who was it that started off that phrase, build back better? If we go back to, what was it, No Smoke 3, perhaps, episode 3, The Green King, yeah. We were talking about the fact that it was Charles that actually coined the phrase build back better back in 2019. So in order to build back better, whether that be humanity, humans, transhumans, or whether it be the planet, returning it to biodiversity, you have to destroy it first in order to build back better.
Yeah. Well, okay, that's been our little introduction today, just to get people thinking. And we'll say, if you're new to this topic altogether, please do go back to episode 1 and catch up with us, because there's been a lot of material covered. But is it true to say that we've moved through Charles, what he's up to with his connections with a range of organisations and people, corporations, non-governmental organisations, think tanks, charities. We've talked about some of his spiritual connections, but actually when you get in some of his spiritual stuff, it seems to get a bit darker. And you've got an interesting video clip, I think, for us.
Well, you know, we did a lot in episode 4 on the Commonwealth and Kanzuk. And I just wanted to refresh people's memories a little bit as to the last Commonwealth Games that was held in Birmingham. And I'm sure many of our viewers and listeners will remember it and the involvement of the then Prince Charles. But I've got a little bit of video that I thought might just remind people.
It is time now for the 2022 Commonwealth Games opening ceremony here at the Alexander Stadium in Birmingham.
The Prince of Wales and the Duchess of Cornwall to represent Her Majesty the Queen tonight. Now time to meet Stella and the Dreamers.
And they're going to meet some of the key figures from Brum's history.
But of course, for all the colour and noise, the characters, the invention, there was a dark side to the Industrial Revolution, a darker side to the bullring.
As the beat pound to remind us of the relentless drive of industry, they drag a beast, a bull, 10 metres high.
And enraged by injustice, the bull breaks free and causes pandemonium.
Bulls were baited and sold here in the city century for centuries.
It's no doubt going to be up to Stella and the Dreamers to try and halt the bull.
Stella offers friendship and compassion to tame the beast.
It now gives me the greatest pleasure to declare the 22nd Commonwealth Games open.
Wow.
So, but you know, it was interesting because they said, you know, the dark ages. Well, there was quite a lot of dark stuff, I think, that went on in that opening ceremony. And we can't show all of it, of course, but I've just taken a few screenshots and you might just like to talk through them, Brian.
This is two close-up shots of the bull. So on the left, we've got the lady finally taming this raging bull. But then we've got everybody sat down in a circle around the bull. It's almost as though they're worshipping the bull. And can I just add, I cannot believe that Charles would attend this event and take part in the opening ceremony unless he actually knew what all this symbology was really about. Symbology that wasn't declared in any detail to the public who were watching.
Yeah. Well, yes, absolutely, 100%. And of course, let's not forget, he drove himself there in his Aston Martin, which he's previously said the fuel should be champagne. Or fine wine, I think. So, I mean, this is all ostentatious. Ugh.
Yeah. And you've got another one of the building on fire here. Is this destroying the old, I wonder?
Well, I mean, to me, I mean, this was the opening ceremony. This was taken from the opening ceremony. And to me, it looks like the Tower of Babel. I don't know about you, but it slightly resembles the Tower of Babel to me. But, I mean, you know, clearly, when you look at some of these opening ceremonies, and even if you go back to the London 2012 Olympics, we all remember the empty NHS beds and Voldemort and all the kind of dark stuff that was going on. So, you know, the royal family, they must know the symbology. If we do and we can see it, surely they can. They're there.
Yeah. Plus, he's interested in some rather dark stuff. This was the thing that captured my interest with the book, The Prince and the Paranormal, because although in some ways there isn't a lot of detail in the book, there's enough, and there's enough historical factual information to show that there's been a tremendous relationship between members of the royal family going back over many years and occult practices, including Ouija boards. But he's also been pretty close to the dark. Sorry, Charles has also been pretty close to the dark stuff.
Oh, well, he wouldn't want you to think that, but of course, but, I mean, I thought to myself, if I was, and I asked you, Brian, you know, in one of our phone conversations, I said to you, if somebody was interviewing you and they asked about your spiritual, mystical, whatever beliefs, what would you say? And your answer was exactly the same as mine. And we would be talking about our spiritual faith in God, Jesus, Christian terms, right? And I thought I'd just go back and look. And I found this archived interview that took place with the then Princess of Wales, Prince Charles and Princess Diana together. And just keep an eye on the body language as you watch. Have a look.
Does that extend to your interest in spiritualism? Mysticism?
Well, yes, absolutely. Again, it's entirely, I think, I've been riveted by the way in which all this has developed, because I have seen articles shown to me saying that I play with Ouija boards, which I don't even know what they are. Literally, I've never seen one. And I you know, and I spend my entire time apparently trying to get in touch with Lord Mountbatten and all sorts of other people. The answer is I don't, nor would I necessarily want to. It all stemmed from, I might as well emphasize it, because I'm fed up with getting letters from people all the time saying, don't touch the Ouija boards. And, it's bad for your health. And it all started because I happened to be a great admirer of the author, Arthur Koestler, who's a great man, I think, a brilliant writer, and above all else, a scientist, really. And he, as you know, left a bequest in his will. I hope you don't mind me going on about this. Saying that when he committed suicide with his wife, that this money should go to found a chair for the study of parapsychology in a British university. And so I ultimately, as Chancellor of the University of Wales, wrote to the Vice-Chancellor when there was a severe danger of no university taking up this offer and it going to the United States, and said, you know, I urge you to apply for this. It would be a great pity to lose it, because it's an interesting area to study scientifically. And to my amazement, the University Council agreed, made the application. In the end, they weren't successful. It went to Edinburgh University. But there was a certain amount of publicity about the fact that I, you know, suggested this. And it stemmed from that. But what I find so annoying is that it should be reduced again to this level of total absurdity. I'm not interested in the occult or dabbling in black magic or any of these kinds of things, or for that matter, strange sort of forms of mysticism. I am purely interested in being open-minded. I mean, after all, there are so many inventions and things that have happened and been proved scientifically in the past, which everybody totally poo-pooed before they were proven. And I think that it is an area which is worth studying sensibly and within the right scientific bounds.
Now, there is one area where I suspect there is one architect who doesn't think you have an open mind, and that's when you have spoken about the extension to the National Gallery, the carbuncle. Now, is it part of your job to start controversy?
I think so, yes, as long as it's not party political controversy. I mean, I open myself, don't I, to every kind of accusation. I'm only too aware of that, and I don't do it lightly. I take a deep breath. A very deep breath, because I know what's going to happen. It's just that I feel that certain things have to be said. And if you skirt round the issues all the time, how do we ever get anywhere in life? Do you know what I mean? And I just feel that sometimes, not too often, I can throw a rock into a pond and watch the ripples create a certain amount of discussion. Hopefully to try and see whether something better can come out of it ultimately.
Well, Debbie, it's incredible, isn't it, when you see clips like that. There's so, again, in that single clip, there's so much we can talk about. But one of the things that just smacked me straight between the eyes was, you know, I don't get involved in things political, but he's drowning. We're now demonstrating this man is drowning in politics, not only national politics, but global politics. So that one is very interesting. But his denial of what he doesn't get involved in, the book about the prince and the paranormal, demonstrates that actually he's been involved in a lot of stuff, which people, and I'm going to push this point, who are devout Christians should be saying, what on earth is this man playing with?
Oh, you just don't go near any of that stuff, do you? You just don't. I mean, especially if you're the head of the Church of England and if you're a Christian, you just don't. But I thought what was interesting was he said, oh, I don't know what a Ouija board would be. Well, why are you talking about them then? If you don't know what they are, why are you even talking about them? And did you notice when he said, I don't do black magic, I don't do any. Don't have anything to do with black magic or the occult. He immediately folded his arms, which is, to me, I'm not a body language expert by any stretch, but when you see people suddenly close their arms like that, fold their arms, you think, oh, you know, you notice it, don't you? And I thought maybe because I was kind of a similar age to Diana and I didn't notice it at the time, but, she, you know, to see her sitting there, she almost looked like a child. I mean, I know she was almost a child bride. She was 19, I think. but she looked so young, and that struck me as well, looking back.
Yeah, so a pretty strong denial of anything wrong, but why would he be so sensitive? Well, we've put a couple of books for people to read if they want to go in a slightly different direction to find out about Charles. So this brings us back onto the subject of the Commonwealth, I think, which is, as we've already told.
Well, very briefly. Yeah, really, really briefly, because this was kind of new news, and I just wanted to slot, because we are going to get a little bit darker, and we're going to go to the people that Charles surrounds him with, himself with, but just to interrupt that with this little bit of news that came out. So I noticed this, that the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting is going to be held in Samoa in this year, in October the 21st. And then I suddenly saw an article just recently, because as we know now, you know, the king has got a diagnosis of cancer and he's been out of the public eye and he's been receiving his chemotherapy. However, this article appeared in the Evening Standard, which suggests that he's raring to go on a tour, no less, to Australia. But what I found interesting about this article was the way that he'd said he can't hang about, he can't hang around, and he's desperate to go on this state visit. But it all ties in very nicely, October, doesn't it, with the Commonwealth Head of Government meeting, which he is determined to attend. So I just wanted to throw that in because that's kind of like new news, bringing us up to date. I thought that was an interesting
clip.
Yeah. I just thought it was interesting. You know, this man's got cancer. He can't allegedly got cancer. He can't appear in public in the UK. He's recovering, and yet he's really desperate to get to the heads of government meeting,
where he says he's going as head of state. And what he's involved in is world politics. That's why he's desperate to go, I think.
Yeah, I mean, well, watch this space. I wonder what's going to happen in October. That seems to be it's going to be an interesting month, especially with the elections coming up as well in November, if we get to a US election, of course. But I mean, that was just to throw that in. But I promised everybody that we'd get to who surrounds our king. And perhaps I know a lot of our members and viewers want us to talk about the Rothschilds, don't they?
Okay. Well, you've got a video clip, I think.
I have a little bit. Let's have a look.
Letter in modern Jewish history. And it begins with three words. Dear Lord Rothschild.
Dear Lord Rothschild, I have much pleasure in conveying to you, on behalf of His Majesty's government, the following declaration of sympathy with Jewish Zionist aspirations, which has been submitted to and approved by the Cabinet.
Why was it that this letter was sent by the Foreign Secretary to your great uncle Walter?
It's an interesting question, because it was primarily a movement from Eastern Europe. But they didn't clarify who was in charge of that movement. And in addition, it was, after all, in Great Britain. So they felt that the Rothschild family should be the one to whom it was addressed. And Walter was Lord Rothschild, and he was a Zionist. And those really are the background reasons.
So Walter received the Balfour Declaration, and I have a copy here. And I wonder if I could possibly ask you to read it for us.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. I'm going to put on my spectacles to make sure I read it accurately. His Majesty's government view with favour the establishment of Palestine as a national home for the Jewish people, and will use their best endeavours to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine, or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. I should be grateful if you would bring this declaration to the knowledge of the Zionist Federation. Yours, Arthur Balfour.
And here it is, the Balfour Declaration. What do you feel when you see it here?
I genuinely feel it's one of the most extraordinary moments in the history of the Jewish people. If you think it took 3,000 years to get to this. And then you say, how did this miracle happen? It's the most incredible piece of opportunism. I mean, if you think you had an impoverished would-be scientist, Chaim Weizmann, who somehow gets to England, meets a few people, including members of my family, seduces them. He has such great charm and conviction. He gets to Balfour, and he unbelievably persuades Balfour and Lloyd George, the Prime Minister, and most of the ministers, that this idea of the national home for Jews should be allowed to take place. I mean, it's so, so unlikely. Then he's, you know, starts to fight a difficult battle with the British cabinet, and this letter goes through five drafts, as you know. And in the end, it comes out as a rather compromising letter. I mean, the essential point is there for the Jewish community to fasten onto. You have the first bit, which promises a national home rather than the national home. And then you have the bit that nothing that's to be done should in any way harm the Arab community. But you come back to the big point, which is that this is perhaps the greatest event in Jewish life for thousands of years. And it's a miracle.
Cut off in his prime, but the point was there, Debbie, absolutely. And again, my goodness, there's so much to talk about in that. Just picking out a couple of things. So we are led to believe that there was a movement connected with the Jewish community in Eastern Europe, but nobody was in charge. It was all just a bit vague. And then I can't remember the gentleman's name who comes across to England, and Rothschild says he gets to England. He just somehow gets to England. And then what a strange expression. He seduces the people he comes into contact with. Does he mesmerize them? He seduces them. And Lord Rothschild is saying that it's all very unlikely. Absolutely right, it's unlikely, because the more he described the process, the more unlikely it seemed to me that this was just some amazing accidental event in history. Yeah. Five drafts of the letter. And then the last bit is so poignant, isn't it? Because he points out that a homeland for the Jewish people is created on the basis that there's to be no harm for the existing Arabs living in that area. And here we are in 2024, where I'm not sure what the figure is now for Gaza alone, but 35,000 plus people killed. So that would say to me, surely Israel must be in breach of the Balfour Declaration. But we're heading in a slightly different direction. Over to you.
We are, but I thought it was very relevant to bring that in because of the at the moment, the days that we're living in at the moment. And, you know, that was Jacob Rothschild, who's just recently died. But when we start looking, and I have been looking at the Rothschilds family, and it is a phenomenal history when you look back and you see the spread of the five sons to different places and the intermarrying, marrying within, you know, cousins, nieces, nephews. It's quite extraordinary. But I just want to bring your attention to Charles Rothschilds. He wasn't really into banking so much. He was really into nature and science and conservation. So let's look a little bit more in depth at Charles Rothschild. He was responsible for setting up the first nature reserve at Wicken Fen. He promoted the Society for the Promotion of Nature. That was the forerunner to the Wildlife Partnerships. And he was responsible for the Rothschild List, which was a list of 284 precious sites and sites that needed to be preserved, because Charles Rothschild's very much into the environment, as you can see. So this is where it all started with the Rothschild List. And you can see there that he had a daughter Miriam Rothschild. And when you look at Miriam Rothschild, you can see that actually she was responsible pretty much for the King's Garden and for rewilding wildflower meadows and restoring life and species diversity. So we've got a heavy involvement, as we know, with the Rothschilds. But I know that our viewers and listeners are probably saying, do you remember that picture of I think it was Evelyn de Rothschild poking the then Prince Charles in the chest, looking very much as though he was in control. You remember that one, don't you, Brian?
I absolutely do, because it's such a telling image. Who has, we'll call it the self-confidence first, self-confidence, and clearly the power to back that self-confidence up, to poke Charles in the chest like that. Somebody who has no worry about who they are. The finger comes out and he gets stabbed in the chest. Very telling image.
Money. All to do with money again. But, you know, we'll come back to the Rothschilds because, I mean, we will come back. But let's just look at a few of the people that the royal family like to keep company with, shall we? Just a few of them.
Well, we got the first one on screen, and of course, it's Rolf Harris.
Yes, he painted the Queen's portraits. And the, for viewers and listeners abroad that may not know the history of Rolf Harris, but he was jailed for, was it child abuse or was it? I can't remember the charges. Yeah.
Yes. And the other bit I want to comment on this, Debbie, is that the image of the Queen that he painted was very controversial. Many people found it actually quite an offensive picture because it was just not of the normal sort of accurate portrait style. One could say it was impressionism, but if it was his impression of the Queen, there were a lot of people who thought it was rather dark.
Yeah. So we've got a celebrity, because Rolf Harris, celebrity there. Now let's go to the church. So who else have we got surrounding the royal family? Well, here we've got Bishop Peter Ball, the former Bishop of Gloucester, former Bishop of Lewes, indecent assaults on boys, former Church of England bishop who describes Prince Charles as a loyal friend.
Yeah, and this
nice company, eh?
Charles eventually gave this man accommodation on one of the estates for him to actually stay in.
It's not looking good, is it? But it's not just the faith. It's not just religion. It's his own family. Let's look at his own family. There you have Lord Mountbatten.
Yeah, and the headline is Lord Mountbatten abused boy 11 in children's home.
So we've got quite a lot of dark company. And of course, then there's his brother, the King's brother. Let's not forget Prince Andrew. And of course, the huge ongoing Epstein case.
Yeah. And this is remarkable because, of course, this meeting with Epstein and Andrew took place in New York. I think they were in Central Park at the time. And Jeffrey Epstein had been convicted at that stage. So it wasn't as if Andrew didn't know. He clearly did know. But
oh, no. He did. But it was the gentlemanly thing to do. Remember the interview? It was the honourable thing to do, to go to see him in person, because it was a place to stay as well. I mean, really? I cringe when I think of that interview. And we haven't even got to the Prince Andrew interview yet. But I mean, one of the most prevalent ones, let's go to Jimmy Savile, because I know everybody's going to be saying, well, why haven't you shown Jimmy Savile? Well, we're going to be showing quite a bit of Jimmy Savile, aren't we?
Yeah. And what an exclusive from the Mirror here. Prince Charles wanted Jimmy Savile to be Prince Harry's godfather, it's been claimed. He said Charles allegedly included the paedophile in a draft list of potential godparents weeks after his second son, Harry, was born in 1984. And that article was by Russell Myers, the royal editor. Presumably he was close enough to the family to know what he was reporting.
I think we're going to find that... Well, you know, patterns. Let's look at patterns. We'll come to that in a minute, but there's quite a lot. I mean, I was shocked, to be honest, Brian. I mean, you know, we all, well, here in the UK, we all know the significance of the Savile Charles connection. We all know that. But I had no idea till I started actually looking how many times he'd met him. And I mean, here you can see, you know, it's shocking. he was an advisor to the king, and even wrote guidance for the queen.
Yeah, program reveals Savile produced a PR handbook for royals, some of which was passed on to the queen. Prince Charles repeatedly sought the advice of Jimmy Savile, who was later revealed to have spent decades sexually abusing women and children, even going so far as to take his suggestions to the Queen, a documentary has claimed. Now, some people would say, oh, well, the trouble with Charles is that he's a bit of an eccentric. He's not that bright. But the episodes of The Green King to date that we've done, Debbie, absolutely show a different man. This is a man actually with a very sharp intellect who's got his nose in all sorts of things, politics, rewilding, sustainable goals, all of this stuff. So this isn't a man who is likely to miss something.
No, absolutely not. And, you know, many people do say to me, oh, you know, eccentric, talking to plants, and he has these weird ways. Yeah, I'm sure he does. But he spends a lot of time reading. And he's, like I say, he's a political businessman. He's a sales. He's built this whole empire in all of these years that we've been watching him as the heir in waiting. It's all been a deliberate ploy to build up this agenda. I'm not saying he's done it on his own, because he couldn't possibly have done it on his own. But, you know, I've spoken to people that have said, well, you know, is he kind of a victim of this? Has he been groomed, and is he the bit? Well, no, because he's gone through, how old is Charles now? 76. You know, he was heir to the throne for 50 years. And I'm sorry, but if something appears a bit dodgy during that time, you get to know about it, right? And you step away from it. You walk away from it if you don't like what it is, or you discover something bad about the things that you're doing, or an underlying agenda. But he doesn't ever step away. He steps further in. He wants more. He embraces the statue, the saviour of the world statue. He enjoys it all. So for anyone to say that this isn't deliberate, I would challenge that, because clearly we're seeing evidence that this is a very deliberate plan to asset grab as much land and wealth as possible for him and the nobility, and those that have got, like I call, the Willy Wonka golden ticket to the brave new world.
Yeah. So he's got Jimmy Savile around him, and you've got some images here just stressing this. I mean, these have been all over the press. They were for many years, and we can see the close and happy, smiling relationship. It's all happy, it's all jolly, but it shows that Savile was remarkably close to him. Savile was, of course, invited into the royal estates and the royal homes. This wasn't a relationship that sort of just popped up at one period. This is a relationship that developed as time went on. But of course, the other thing is that Charles had his royal protection team around him. And that was a mixture of special protection officers and special branch at the time. And their job was to make sure that nobody dangerous ever came near him or other members of the royalty. So what are we saying? That the royal protection team had no idea about the background of Jimmy Savile? I'm going to say to our audience, that simply cannot be true. But have a look at this one from the Mail Online. So this is dated the 5th of October, 2014. Police admit they were told Jimmy Savile was a paedophile a decade before he was exposed. Surrey police admitted they were told Savile was a paedophile in 2003. Journalist called with information that a victim had been abused, but the force did nothing with the tip-off and no crime record was created. Now, I'm going to say, well, what a surprise, the police did nothing. But if questions just come up on the screen as well, because we asked at the time this came up what the NSPCC, Children's Protection Charity, was doing. about what was going on around this. Maybe we'll have to do that separately another time. But if anybody says, oh, well, the police knew, but they didn't do anything and that was the end of it. No, that's not how the system works. The police knew, and the fact that Saville was doing what he was doing would have gone into, I'll call it, the gossip chain around the police. And it would be inevitable that the Royal Protection Team would pick up on that gossip. And so they did nothing as well. And later on, we were to learn, of course, that the security services themselves knew what was happening, but did nothing. So this is an incredible story. Let's turn it around the other way. It's just my question. Was Saville being protected because he had a relationship with the royal family? That's a rather more interesting question.
Answers on a postcard, please, everybody.
Yep, so another Mail headline here, but it says BBC reporter who tried to expose Jimmy Savile's scandal claims he has now been forced out of his job along with other colleagues on the right side of the argument. And this is Merrin Jones says that whistleblowers were forced out by BBC bosses. Well, you know, let's say that's a claimed headline, you know, that's a claim. What real investigation was done to follow up on it? Now we know what we do about Jimmy Savile. And here's a timeline that's come up on the screen. Starting in 2010, former BBC Director General George Entwistle has sent an email telling him about the real truth about paedophile Jimmy Savile. And it goes right the way through to December the 19th, 2012, where Peter Rippon's replaced as editor of Newsnight. So a complete cover-up by the BBC. But as we've just shared with our audience, the police knew way before that what Jimmy Savile was up to. It's pretty incredible.
Yeah, it is. But, you know, what's interesting about the whole Jimmy Savile thing is at least it came out. Right. So that's why we've got all of this news now. And we know who Jimmy Savile was, what he was responsible for. I mean, I'm sure there's much that will still come out and much that we'll never find out because it was so big. But we found out because it was splattered all over the mainstream media. And remember, you know, Prince Charles, as he was then, was considering using or asking Jimmy Savile to become Prince Harry's godfather. Well, the reason I say it's a pattern is because let's look at who else very quietly supports the then Prince Charles. And let's meet Prince William's godparents. And I want to introduce you to Laurens van der Post. And not many people have heard of this man at all. So there's an article in The Guardian that has a pretty telling headline, which was that Laurens van der Post was a writer, war hero and guru to Prince Charles and Margaret Thatcher. But, says his biographer, J.D.F. Jones, he was also a compulsive liar whose hatred of Mandela proved a threat to South Africa's future. But if we go on a bit further into that article, there's so much to say. So I want to just basically summarise a little bit about Laurens van der Post. So he was one of 13 children, and he was the 13th. He was a South African writer, but he was a spiritual mentor for Prince Charles. So he was the spiritual mentor for Prince Charles. He died in 1996, and he was said to be a very colourful character, really colourful, but a complete fantasist and actually a liar. And it turned out that he was a liar. But he had a secret, and the secret he was desperate to keep that never really came out until after his death was that he'd had an illicit affair with a 14-year-old and had had a child with this 14-year-old. And this was all kept a secret. It was a girl called Kari Mostert. She came forward revealing her underage mum had been seduced by Laurens van der Post on a boat trip to England. But he was absolutely terrified all his life that the truth would come out. He spoke regularly to Margaret Thatcher and advised her during the Falklands conflict. He embellished every story that he told. He served in the Second World War, Ethiopia, Western Desert and Burma. He was captured in Java by Japanese and held for 3 years, which fascinated Prince Charles. And after the war, he served with nobody else, Mountbatten, would you believe? Well, yes, you probably would believe. And after that, he headed an expedition to Botswana, wrote loads of books, but he's also, he kind of maneuvered himself in as a great friend of Sir James Goldsmith, and we'll be coming onto the Goldsmith connection in a minute.
So Debbie, go on.
Well, no, I was just going to say he said he was a great friend of Jung. This was his best mate. Mm. He made it all up. He met him very, very late in life. And farming and Tetbury, and it all comes back down to the Queen Mother and Bowes Lyon. I mean, the history around Lawrence van der Post is phenomenal, and yet nobody's talking about it. But basically, one of Prince William's godfathers was a paedophile.
Yeah,
a paedophile.
I was keen to get in there because I'm going to put the book up on screen, The Prince and the Paranormal, again, because the opening chapter is called Secret Safari. And this goes back to 1977 when van der Post took the very, very young Charles into the bush. This was in Kenya, took him into the bush for 7 days. And a lot of people close to Charles said, whatever happened on that trip, and what were they supposedly doing, going back to basics in the bush? So they weren't going to take any Western comforts. You slept on the ground. You had to have a fire at night and take it in turns to stay awake and keep watch in case some wild animals were going to come around. But the public never really knew what took place in the 7 days when van der Post took Charles into the bush. But they say that when Charles came back, he was different. And he never went back to being the young man that he was previously. So we've got this really strange individual who has got the power to take Charles into the bush. And I believe this is right, that there was no security team with him. He completely left the itinerary of his visit to Kenya, and he disappeared off into the bush with this guy. And then when he came back, he was a different man.
Well, I mean, you know, if you start to dig around in what went on with Charles, there were other trips as well. I mean, that's going to be probably another no smoke. Secret trips within this country to secret destinations. And he's led a pretty secret life. But Lawrence van der Post, he also wheedled his way into becoming neighbours to Lillian Bowes Lyon, who was a cousin of the Queen Mother. So you can see the way that he was getting in to pretty much everyone. I mean, I've looked for videos. There are many videos online of Lawrence van der Post, but I just wanted to show our audience just who he was. So this is just a little snippet of him talking about Jung. But don't forget, he's a fantasist and he's also a liar.
1961, the sky suddenly darkened over the lake at Küsnacht. Coincidence for Jung had always been full of meaning.
Just over 10 years ago, almost to a day, Dr. Jung died in this house. Then, as now, it seemed as if nature recognized the event. A great thunderstorm swept over Zurich. Lightning crashed and destroyed one of his favorite trees in the garden just over here where he used to sit. And it was symbolically in the unconscious of hundreds of people who'd known him and read him, as if a great ship had gone down and dragged towards it like flotsam and jetsam on the sea, all sorts of strange dreams and portents to accompany the event. But what was even more significant was the fact that 3 days before he died, Dr. Jung had been quite well, had perhaps the last of the dreams that could be communicated to men. He had just finished his last written work, a work on symbols. And the dream came to him, the first of which said, the first of which showed him high up in a high place, a round boulder, a great boulder of stone. And on this stone was inscribed the words, "Take this as a symbol of your wholeness and the singleness you've become."
Great video there. So we get a feeling for that man. Pretty dark, amazing coincidence that the very day they decide to film about Jung's death, the very same style thunderstorm crops up. Yeah, that's pretty amazing. But he's we're able to see firsthand there his demeanor and his and get an idea of his mindset, the mindset that took Charles into the bush for 7 days to teach him what?
Exactly. What? I mean, he was his spiritual guru. So, I mean, this was a man that had had a child with a 14-year-old. So what was he teaching Charles? What kind of role model was he? What kind of role model was he to Prince William? Did Prince William know about this while he was alive? Probably not. Does Prince William still know? I mean, there are so many, it just
There's
throws out so many
it?
Questions.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
We heard all about Jimmy Savile, but who's, you know, not many people probably have focused in. I'm sure some of our viewers and listeners will have done, and they'll all be saying, oh, yes, Lawrence van der Post. But the majority of people probably won't even know his name.
Yeah.
We've got NGOs, we've got think tanks, we've got bankers, we've got businessmen,
insurance companies.
Who is enabling? Yeah, who's enabling all of that? Charles is clearly the facilitator to all of this that's going on, but there's got to be people that are enabling it, don't you think?
Absolutely.
I don't know how much further you want to go, Brian.
Well, we're going to keep going because we decided where we thought we could get as we analyse this man, but this man is not doing his job, in my opinion, as king of this country, because his interests are onto global issues and astral issues. But we're now getting a feeling for this man. I mean, it's a bit of a crude thing to say, but would I trust him to look after my dog if I was away? Actually, no, is the answer. I don't think I'd want him in my house. Is he doing his best to protect the people in this country that can't feed themselves or haven't got proper homes, or even people in Cornwall who have great difficulty trying to get a family home? And we've got the immense power of the duchy down in Cornwall. He's not interested in those people.
And Wales.
Yeah, and the same going on in Wales. He's off on his global agenda, and we're now beginning to get into his mindset a bit. And as you do this, you just ask more and more questions. But yeah, to me, there's something defective here, which people should be concerned about. What's incredible for me in doing this series with you, Debbie, is that, of course, for 21 years of my life, I was in the Royal Navy, so I was in the heart of the services, the military beast. And a key thing was, you know, ultimate respect to the royal family, that when you were saluting the flag, you were actually saluting the royal family, and the standards of the military were all set with, of course, the senior queen as was at the head of the military, and then senior members of the royal family with very important positions within the military, even if that was an honorary sort of position. But everything was about respect for these people. And then as we dig into it, I'm thinking, my goodness, was I was I absolutely so naive then that I wasn't looking at what these people really were. And I'm happy to say to the audience, no, I wasn't at the time. I had a job to do and you got on with that job. But the thought that you were pressurized often in order to keep these amazingly high standards out of respect for the royalty. And then when you start digging into the royalty, you find that actually life's very, very different.
I'm the same as you, Brian. I bought into all of it. But then, you know, when I look back to when I was growing up, the fates were all waving Union Jacks, the Jubilees, we were all having street parties. My mum, because I was born and brought up in London, my mum used to take me, you know, to see royal occasions when the parades were on and stuff. So, you know, I was the same and it's shocked me as well, hugely, as I'm sure it has many people that are watching. But like we say, every time, you know, we're just putting out the information and it's going to be down to everybody to look at it themselves and make up their own minds. But clearly the royal family, in particular the king, is surrounded by very
questionable
dark people. Yeah, yeah. I mean, and we need to know this because, you know, just last year, I think it was last year, the end of last year, the royal family got a pay rise to their public purse. And I think it was just this week I was watching King Charles looking at the new banknotes that have been issued with his head on. And he's very pleased with them, very proud of them, I bet he is. So, you know, this is an agenda that the public need to know about because we're paying for this.
Yeah. Debbie, it's been absolutely fascinating. So much to discuss. We can only do so much in a reasonable time for the interview. Well, it's not an interview, the discussion. Thank you for joining me and a huge thank you to our audience. And I'll say once again, it's been utterly, utterly brilliant.
Well done. It's a marathon. Well done to everybody that's keeping up with us. Thank you so much because it's so encouraging and it makes me want to do more. So thank you. Thank you very much.
And also brilliant to see people coming in from the Commonwealth countries themselves to say, oh, wow, this is a really interesting series. I've learned a lot already. So have I. And we've got more to come. So we'll end there, Debbie. Thank you very much for joining me today. And I've realised, of course, what an incredible backdrop I've got, because normally we can see at least a little bit of the water, the Plymouth Sound, as it's called, the sea in Plymouth. But today, the mist and the clag has come in and all we've got is that grey background. Mm. So, yeah, maybe for the next episode, we'll get a bit of that spring sunshine.
Can I also thank Stephanie Sinclair as well, because our producer, because it's a team effort. It's you, me and Stephanie, and she's been absolutely amazing helping me put all of this together. Well, helping us put all of this together. So huge thanks to her as well.
Yeah, brilliant. We'll leave it there. Thanks to our audience, wherever you are in the world. We will be back shortly with part 6 of The Green King. Join us then. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.